This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking today with Harvey Schwartz, author of a new book about the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Labor Under Siege, an oral history of Big Bob McElrath and the ILWU's fight for organized labor in an anti-union era. Welcome back to KABU, Harvey.
Hey, hello, Laurie, and thank you for inviting me.
Let me give you a brief introduction, and then we can talk about some of the book's lessons for the labor movement today. Harvey Schwartz is curator of the Oral History Collection at the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU, Library in San Francisco. He's the author of a number of books about working people, including Building the Golden Gate Bridge, A Worker's Oral History, Solidarity Stories, an Oral History of the ILWU, and The March Inland, Origins of the ILWU Warehouse Division. Harvey, you really are an authority on the ILWU, a union that has an important and militant history in the Portland-Vancouver area, not only on the docks, but also at Powell's Books. Why did you write this book about Bob McElrath?
Well, it's a central part of the union's history that's not been written about very much. That is to say, the period from around 1980 through the very recent past, approximately 2018, when Bob retired. He retired at the end of that year. And we had determined, that is, I had and other people, really, and many other people besides me, had determined we should do an oral history with Big Bob before he retires from office. And so I said, sounds like a wonderful idea, and we went forward from there.
And as the book's title, Labor Under Siege, suggests, this is more than a story of one leader. It details some of the rockiest times for American labor in the late 20th century, when unions were losing members and contract battles and the number of strikes, which are labor's most potent weapon, dramatically declined. What were some of these multi-pronged attacks on the ILWU and other unions at this time?
Well, I think it's interesting when you look at it. If you go back in time a little bit, there was kind of a new look on the waterfront in 1948 when the employers decided no more red baiting. They'd get along with Harry Bridges, the original president. And there was kind of an air of good feeling, and there was even a cooperative effort in 1960 for the unions to accept mechanization. And that is really, at that time, containerization. The employers come around the period 1980-81 when Ronald Reagan became the President of the United States, and he basically broke the air controller strike in 1981. And after that, employers became pretty militant in their anti-union stance, including the employers of the longshore workers on the West Coast. And they moved to a position of really opposing bargaining in good faith and negotiations, dragging their heels on a negotiation, trying to undermine contract specifications, which were agreed to, really opposing union comfort in every direction, making the union look bad in particularly, for example, in 2014, the employer cut manning, and it is a number of people on the job, and then charged the union with slowing down, when actually they've been the ones who cut down the number of people on the job. They've used labor law against the Longshore Union, against all American unions, really. The secondary boycott was made illegal under Taft-Hartley, a new law in 1947, or a new, really, an amendment to the old National Labor Relations Act. The employers have pushed automation in many ways, even when automation might not be that efficient, but they want to get rid of the workers, get rid of the people. All you have to do is deal with machines. And they fought organizing that the Longshore Union and other unions really looked at, with captive audiences, you know, who get given the Riot Act, really, unionism is bad for you, etc., selected firing, and so on and so on. So you get the picture. It's really been an era since about 1980, which was coincidentally when Big Bob first got active in the union. It's been an anti-union era. It's really not over now, notwithstanding new stirrings.
So, Harvey, even though Taft-Hartley's passed in 1947, which really restricts American labor did have some degree of power through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and then begins to lose some of its power as it loses members, partly due to mechanization and global competition. But in terms of that mechanization, longshore workers saw their numbers decline by half as a result of that container revolution of the 60s and 70s. And did those pressures from employers to mechanize continue after that?
Oh, yeah. They've continued right to down to the present. There was a big push in Los Angeles to a robotic system in place in one of the big container terminals down there. They've continued to push it. There's no question of that. And what the union has done in response, at least our union and I think other unions, they have tried to say, okay, if you're going to push the machine in, and by the way, there was a plank in an old, actually going back to 1934, a piece of actually the first contract that said labor-saving devices can be moved in. Nobody in 1934 realized how important that was going to be. But there has been an effort by the unions to say, okay, you're going to move this machine in, but whatever jurisdiction remains is going to be ours. That is to say, machine may replace workers, but there are going to be still some people to press the buttons or whatever, and they have to be ILW, and we insist on that. And anything that's left over, that is, any other jobs left over, should also be our jobs within our jurisdiction. And, of course, the union has complained all along, and I think with good reason, that the employers will try to bite around the edges and to limit their work and to take it away and to undermine their position of holding on to their jurisdiction. So that's the union response. But this battle has been ongoing and is still ongoing. I mean, in many ways, the machine is labor-saving, but it's also the enemy of workers. It takes away their jobs, takes the sandwich out of their lunchbox.
And as one union member said, I think in your book, that it's one thing to have power when you have 6,000 other workers behind you, but when there are only 1,000, you know, you have less clout. And
yes,
so mechanization has really reduced that clout just by reducing sheer numbers of workers who can stand together. But speaking of standing together, the ILWU is famous for supporting labor and social justice causes across the West Coast and Pacific, across the globe, actually. How did this union move beyond simple bread and butter unionism, that is just negotiating wage and benefit gains for its own members, to be so active in collectively voicing opposition to unjust actions around the world, such as the war in Iraq?
Yeah, the ILWU has been this way since its beginning in 1933, 1934. Of course, the Great Strike was 1934. And to some degree, I think it's because of Harry Bridges, the original leader, and the people around him. They were what we would call progressives or liberals today. And Bridges, for example, invited black workers in. Other people were involved with him in the union in 1934. And they realized, I mean, there's a practical end to that at that time, that you can keep people from being strike breakers if you invite them in, if you're all-inclusive. Be that as it may, there is this humane streak. And I think it goes back to Harry. And I think, in some sense, Harry's thumb is still on the union, even all these years after his death in 1990. And all the people, I don't know if not everybody, but the great bulk of the people and the officers and so forth, stick with that tradition. And it's still there. And it has served them well.
And they uphold the motto, an injury to one is an injury to all, which really dates back to the Knights of Labor and the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, recognizing this kind of worker struggle across the world.
Oh, absolutely. And I think they still adhere to it. You know, as I say, I think Harry's thumb is still on the union. And there have been so many good leaders, you know, following him, right down to Willie Adams, who's president right now of the International. And they've just stuck with that humane perspective. In the book I did, there's a section in the latter part of the book about aiding Native Americans in their struggle against a pipeline in the Dakotas and things like that. And the union has stood for accepting black workers and supporting black rights all the way through from, you know, from 1934 onward.
The book focuses on the leadership of Mikhail Rath, who had to steer the ILWU through multiple challenges. And the book raises some interesting questions about the role of compromise and how to survive in an anti-union era. So, I mean, what did you learn from all these interviews you conducted with members about how far unions can go in making demands or in committing to actions when labor law, such as it is in the United States, is so against you?
You have to be militant the way the union has been. You have to try. You go out and organize. All the organizing drives they tried were not successful. Some were. But you have to keep after it. And yet you have to be prudent in one sense to know that if you go too far, you're going to get in trouble and you're going to get hit with Taft-Hartley charges. For example, the union was sued a few years ago under a secondary boycott part of the Taft-Hartley Act. So you've got to go for it, but you've got to also realize, you know, that there are times when you might have to back off. The union was very militant in the so-called EGT strike, which that's really a group called the Export Grain Terminal, around the year 2011. And they fought tooth and nail. They really did. In the end, when the Coast Guard was coming up the river to open fire on the workers if they blocked a delivery at one terminal, And they had let it be known they were going to open fire, and they were going to, you know, they were going to kill workers, and the workers were going to stand against that. They were going to stand up to it. Miguel Ruff realized, you know, well, we have to go for a deal at this point. I don't want to get all our guys killed. And the governor of the state of Washington at that time came up with a program in which the deal was cut. Union didn't come out in a perfect shape. It came out, you know, it got jurisdiction in that plant, which is what they were after to begin with. So you have to be careful. You got to be prudent, you know.
And that was a struggle up in Longview, right?
Well, that's right.
Local 40.
Well, that was actually Local 21 in Longview.
Mm-hmm.
Local 40 is the ship clerks group in Portland. And I'm sure they were there because everybody went up there to help from the different locals.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, can help the labor movement today as it is reasserting itself. What other lessons can the labor movement learn from ILWU strategies, advances and mistakes during this anti-union period of the late 20th, early 21st centuries?
Well, as I was noting, one thing, you got to pick your battles, and you got to be careful about it. You have to be prudent when it's important to be prudent, but you have to fight for survival and for expansion and organizing when you can. Sometimes you have to accept compromises and treats, but you have to be smart about it. And I think that can benefit people, that is to say, what's in the book can benefit people who look at this, at their experiences moving forward. The other thing about that, which I think is important, is people can look at this experience of this union and say, notwithstanding it was a tough time, those guys survived and those women survived with a democratic, worker-driven, honest, progressive organization. For example, in the book, there's some discussion of the longshore caucuses, which would meet before negotiations would occur. And at that time, everybody would come from as representatives from different ports and different locals, and they would discuss, you know, what we want from our port and, you know, what this other group of folks might want. And they would come to a consensus as to what the negotiations were going to include. That is to say, what we're going to ask for. And it seems to me that that might be helpful for people to look at that and see how, from the inside, you know, democratic decisions were come to and that benefit and help the union move forward. And in addition to that, if you look at this book, you know, you've got a social justice union, and still in all, you can fight to keep that tradition and, you know, maintain a democratic, clean, rank-and-file-running organization and still battle for the party of humanity. So I think there are a lot of lessons that can be taken in this regard, you know, from looking at the ILWU's experience.
And inspiring all of us for a new movement that will unite workers of the world. Thanks so much, Harvey Schwartz, for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour and for telling us about your new book, Labor Under Siege, available at Powell's Books. And if you order from Powell's through the Local 5 website, the local receives over 7% of the sale for its strike fund. And we'll provide a link to it, heyboo.fm. So long, Harvey.
Thank you again. Thank you so much, Lori.